Welcome back to The Damage Report, everybody. I'm Johnny DiRola. It is a big show. I'm gonna be running solo for the most part, but we do have guests who are gonna be joining us throughout the hour to break down some really important topics. So in not long, Fox News, the way they say it, they've got their opinion side and they've got their fact side. But the problem with their fact side is that they don't have facts on their side. And we're gonna break down exactly why that is and how important it actually is for the financial bottom line of Fox, potentially, with a representative of Media Matters joining us in just a little bit. Later on in the show, Alan Holmes of the Center for Public Integrity is gonna be joining us to break down the path that got us to the Trump tax cuts, how significant they've been, some things that we might misunderstand about them, very important financial information we're gonna be breaking down there. And then throughout the show, the theme, I guess, today is battle. A potential coming battle with Iran, and also a battle inside of the Democratic Party when it comes to climate change, with Joe Biden going up against Bernie Sanders and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez on the Green New Deal and a middle road on climate change. We're gonna be breaking down both of those battles. Also, stick around for the end of the show. We've got Meanwhile In, interesting news from around the world, the environment, crossbows, tons of stuff. It's gonna be fun. But we're gonna jump into our first topic first, which makes sense from my point of view. Hold on to your butts, we might have a war with Iran. I know some people were holding out hope that the guy who called himself the most militaristic person in the world would not launch us into more regime change wars, but if he gets his way, if John Bolton gets his way, we could soon be at war with Iran. At a meeting of President Trump's top national security aides last Thursday, Acting Defense Secretary Patrick Shanahan presented an updated military plan that envisions sending as many as 120,000 troops to the Middle East should Iran attack American forces or accelerate work on nuclear weapons. Both of those conditions, by the way, for sending an absolutely massive number of troops are really interesting when you think about them. In the first part, you have should Iran attack American forces. Now, there are unambiguous ways that Iran could attack nuclear forces. There are also ways that we could imagine, you and I, that could theoretically be spun into an attack on American forces that would allow us to engage in an absolutely massive, disastrous war with Iran. We've seen this before in America. We could be seeing it coming up soon. And also, or if it accelerates work on nuclear weapons. Well, that's interesting. We had a way to stop them from accelerating work on nuclear weapons. It was called the Iran Nuclear Accords. It was working pretty well. Trump actually pulled us out of that. Now, Iran seems like they're going to start to resume some of the work. If anybody helped to have Iran accelerate work on their nuclear weapons, he's dwelling in the White House, actually. I would lay the onus on him in this particular case. Now, just to put it in a little bit of historical perspective, the theme of this segment is going to be historical perspective. That 120,000 troops, that's approximately the size that initially invaded Iraq, to give you an idea. And that, by the way, is not being pitched as a force to invade Iran. That's not what they're saying. What they're saying is, this is just the soldiers we need in case they attack US forces somewhere in the region. We would need far, far more to actually invade Iran. And so, if that is their goal, and if they're successful in pursuing that, that 120,000 troops, an absolutely monstrous number that we'd be sending at incredible economic cost to the United States, that would just be an appetizer, and God only knows how big that number could get at some point. Now that, at least as of now, is perspective. It's a plan that they're talking about, but there is already action on the ground and on the water. As a precaution, the Pentagon has already moved an aircraft carrier, B-52 bombers, a Patriot missile interceptor battery, and more naval firepower to the Gulf region, which I'm sure Iran will not take as any sort of provocation. And they will simply keep on keeping on with no extra. How many times have we been through this? We send some threats, then they do something. We send some forces there while telling them that they should not accelerate any sort of their plans or, you know, move any more onto an offensive military footing. Of course, they are going to do that. We will use that to justify God only knows what. We've been down this path. We're still on this path in multiple countries in the region to this point. And Donald Trump himself has tried to get tons of credit for being the guy that has been drawing down forces in the region, even though the drawdowns, if you look closely, are almost always reversed within a few days or a week, and they're not as large as they're pitched to be. But he wants that credit, and here we have us moving in the opposite direction. Now, just to be clear, in case it wasn't clear, the revisions in that plan were ordered by hardliners led by John Bolton. That's Mr. Trump's national security advisor, a guy who has never met a country he did not want to change the regime of. And again, as I said, they're not calling for a land invasion of Iran. That's not anything that they would want. No, they're just sending 120,000 troops to scare them, I guess. And let's see, so Bolton, he has this plan, big action. What about Trump? Oh no, nothing from him. On Monday, asked if he wants regime change in Iran, he said, we'll see what happens with Iran. If they do anything, it would be a very bad mistake. What about our mistakes? What about what we're doing that hypothetically could lead to military action against Iran? That, from my point of view, is a massive mistake. He has got plausible deniability that he's not involved in it. He's just responding to what they're doing. And it's really John Bolton. He's the hardliner. If you have an issue with him, maybe someday we'll kick him out, but not Trump. He won't be tarnished as a guy that gets us involved in another decades-long war in the Middle East. And for people who care about facts, who care about any of this, who've been paying attention, his next quote, we just don't want them to have nuclear weapons. Not too much to ask. See, Iran agrees that that is not too much to ask. In fact, a couple of years ago, they agreed. That is why they signed on to the Iran nuclear accords, accords that everyone agreed they were abiding by. Shockingly, they were abiding by it. But they were, and it was working. It was an incredibly difficult diplomatic achievement, but we were able to get that. And we did not move into some sort of war with Iran, even though many of us were afraid for a number of years that that would be the inevitable result. If John McCain had become president, it certainly seemed like it would be. But even when he was not, there was fear that the military-industrial complex would get what they would want, and we would engage with a war in Iran. And we avoided that. We did not avoid a lot of the other ones in the region, but that one, potentially the biggest, most disastrous war that we can imagine in the region, we did avoid. And then we got Trump. And then the guy who has called himself the most militaristic person in the world, who has surrounded himself with hardliners and xenophobes and radicals and neocons and all of that. What do you know? We might be getting that war at long last. Now, I want to just add a little bit more on top of this, because when you are following the news and you're going to hear about things happening in the region, you're going to see the quotes, you know, Iran's, their leaders, they're saying, you know, we're prepared for everything, the stuff that people always say when they're about to go to war or when they want to avoid it. It's hard to say exactly. You're going to see it from the point of view of America, but more specifically from the point of view of the powers that be that are interested in this conflict, and certainly the economic powers in the military-industrial complex that are going to make a ton of money if we do go to war. And so everything that happens in the region will be spun from that point of view. But at least just briefly, I want to put you in the point of view of a person in Iran, whether in the government or a regular person, because you understand from our point of view, we have pitched everything that they do as a violent provocation. We assume that everything they do is untrustworthy and that they are going to tend towards terrorism and violence in all cases. In many cases, that might be true, but that is the approach that we have for virtually everything that they do. Now imagine if you were growing up in Iran and you have studied the history of the US's interaction with Iran. Let's go over just a few of the highlights that might make it a little bit more difficult to actually take anything the US says at face value. Back in 1953, the CIA was involved in a coup against the democratically elected government of Mohammad Mossadegh. We took it out. They have devolved into theocracy as a result of our involvement in their democratic processes. When Iraq invaded Iran, a war which killed hundreds of thousands of people in Iran, we enthusiastically supported Saddam Hussein, which was a great call in a number of different ways, and probably not something that after just a couple of decades, the people of Iran are going to forget. By the way, we also shot down Iran Air 655, killing all 290 passengers and crew on there. It was a mistake, we said. But that didn't bring them back. That was a big one. Now imagine if Iran had shot down a JetBlue flight killing hundreds of people. Would we forget that so soon? I don't think so. And then, just a couple of decades later, we tell them we want an accord with you on stopping the future of your nuclear program. And I know that you've got a half century plus of reasons not to trust us at all, but just trust us here. And we engage in that process, we get the accord. And then a couple of years go by and we violate that accord. We pull out of it, violating our end of that bargain that they had agreed to. Shockingly, again, that they had agreed to it, but they did, and we pulled out of it. And now, what are our demands? I mean, we say we don't want them to have nuclear weapons, but we're certainly not acting like it in the way that we engage them diplomatically. From my point of view, there should be a couple of very easy asks. First of all, no war with Iran. I think that literally everyone, regardless of where you reside in the political spectrum, should be able to agree on that. It would be a disaster that would kill at the very least hundreds of thousands of people, if not far more. Iran is not Iraq when we invaded it. as a far more capable military force, that would be an absolute disaster. And Iraq, of course, was by itself. Two, get rid of John Bolton. He should have no role whatsoever in government. He shouldn't even be appearing on a Bill Maher panel, let alone actually pulling strings at the Pentagon and putting us on the war footing that we're on with Iran right now. And three, reimplementation of the Iran nuclear accords. Look, if it's necessary to get everyone to sign on, Republicans who are completely disingenuous in the way that they have portrayed the past nuclear accords, then have more rigorous and more constant on-site examinations if that's necessary. It's possible, maybe, if we play our cards right and if we move fast, that we could actually get Iran to sign back on to that. I have my doubts, but it's certainly worth a try if it could lead to hundreds of thousands of people not dying needlessly in a war that so many people in US government seem to be pushing for right now. This is a little bit of depressing news, I apologize. But we could be entering into something that could again lead us to stay for multiple decades in the Middle East when we have an opportunity to actually pull our forces out, to not needlessly be involved in the internal workings of all of those countries. They want to double dip us in there. Now we're going to take a short break. When we come back, we're going to turn to Fox News. Their news side, how newsy is it? How devoted to the facts is it? We'll give you the facts after this.
We need to talk about a relatively new show called the Republic, or UNFTR. As a Young Turks fan, you already know that the government, the media, and corporations are constantly peddling lies that serve the interests of the rich and powerful. But now there's a podcast dedicated to unraveling those lies, debunking the conventional wisdom. In each episode of the Republic, or UNFTR, the host delves into a different historical episode or topic that's generally misunderstood or purposely obfuscated by the so-called powers that be, featuring in-depth research, razor-sharp commentary, and just the right amount of vulgarity, the UNFTR podcast takes a sledgehammer to what you thought you knew about some of the nation's most sacred historical cows. But don't just take my word for it. The New York Times described UNFTR as consistently compelling and educational, aiming to challenge conventional wisdom and upend the historical narratives that were taught in school. For as the great philosopher Yoda once put it, "You must unlearn what you have learned." And that's true whether you're in Jedi training or you're uprooting and exposing all the propaganda and disinformation you've been fed over the course of your lifetime. So search for UNFDR in your podcast app today and get ready to get informed, angered, and entertained all at the same time.
Fox News often likes to claim that there are two sides to their business. There's the opinion side, you know, your Sean Hannity's and your Tucker Carlson's, and you know, they're super hardcore conservatives. They come at the news from that perspective, and they're not journalists. You can't really hold them to any sort of high standards in terms of accountability to the facts or ethics or anything like that. But they also have their news side, and that is as legitimate as the news sides of any other cable news channel. Well, is that actually the truth? Joining us now to break it down is Katie Sullivan, Deputy Director of Rapid Response at Media Matters for America. Katie, welcome to the Damage Report.
Thanks for having me.
Glad to have you on. So you were involved in a new report, The Fox News Lie. And what did you find in your analysis of the hard news side of Fox News?
Yeah, so as you mentioned, Fox likes to tout the hard news side of its operation as a way to counter, you know, people calling out the lies, conspiracy theories, propaganda, bigotry that pervade the network. We looked at the first 4 months of 2019, so January 1st to April 30th, and found that every single day, somebody who reports to the news division pushed some misinformation themselves. We looked at this four-month period not because it was some aberration, just because, you know, let's look at 2019 and see what happened. This isn't an aberration. This is just Fox News's whole model. And, you know, we did limit this just to people who are, you know, anchors, reporters. We didn't even include the opinion people or outside guests who are brought onto these news programs and who lie with impunity and don't get any pushback from the news anchors.
So just to be clear, when you're talking about every day on the hard news side, there were lies. You're not talking about they framed something from a conservative point of view or they input their opinion on a topic. You mean verifiable facts that they either misstated either accidentally or intentionally.
Yeah, I mean, I would say misinformation, not necessarily lies, but you know, for, I mean, a lot of it was just lies, but some of it was, you know, just incorrectly stated things. But, you know, that matters when it's the viewer. And we also, I don't think, can necessarily attribute to, you know, mistaken, but in good faith. You know, for example, we found that the four buckets of most common misinformation in our research were misinformation about the Mueller report, misinformation about the Green New Deal, misinformation about issues related to immigration and the border, and misinformation about proposals to increase taxes on the wealthy. I think it's interesting that it was those four buckets in particular, mm-hmm. because those are things that are aligned very much with, frankly, the Republican Party. You know, Fox News has for a while been a propaganda wing for the Republican Party. And this really, I think, helps demonstrate that.
You know, it's funny. I was going to ask you if there were patterns in the topics. And those four buckets, I think I could have gotten probably three out of the four if I'd guessed. But I also assume that's probably a significant percentage, if not a majority, of all of what they talk about, or at least what it seems like they talk about over the last few months, is hammering home a couple of core topics and returning them. And so it seems like if misinformation is coming in those areas, I mean, what good are these claims that this is, they're just journalists, you know, that they might be on a network with people who have opinion. It seems like that reputation that they're trying to accrue is probably not deserved.
Exactly. I think immigration is one really good example. We have done other studies in the past showing that Fox talks about immigration issues more than CNN and MSNBC do. And this is what happens when the majority of the public, you know, cable conversation about a topic is happening on Fox, and a good chunk of what's happening there isn't even true. That does not contribute to a very well-informed population, citizenry, electorate, American, you know, body.
Yeah, and so that's interesting. I mean, so you can look at individual statements and you can ascertain whether they're true or not. But also in topic selection, they can lead people to believe that certain topics are more important than others. I mean, look, I would agree that, like, for instance, the Green New Deal is certainly worthy of discussion. But if your coverage is going to be spreading misinformation and false ideas of what actually is, it'd probably be preferable that you didn't talk about it at all. And so There are certainly multiple ways that you can deceive. Some are a little bit harder to like exactly put a pin in, but there are multiple ways that you can do that. And I'm also curious, so Media Matters is putting out this report at a time when the reputation of Fox for their ability to be, you know, reliable journalists and all that might be important. So they're actually doing some advertiser like presentations and things like that at this point as well, correct?
Yes, that's right. They have their upfronts right now, which is they're selling all of their ad space for 2020 to basically middlemen who will then send sell that space to companies. And right now, you know, I think that these people who are buying that ad space need to think really hard about whether that's actually a good investment.
Yeah, exactly. And so I am curious. I know that Media Matters has talked a little bit about some of the attempts to get advertisers to flee Fox. And I know that quite a few certainly had from Tucker Carlson and a few other shows, Jeanine Pirro, I think. Do we have any idea of sort of updated numbers? Is that a trend that actually continued, or did some of those advertisers end up coming back once the public had sort of lost interest in the topic?
No, most of those advertisers have stayed away.
Oh, wow. Okay, well, that's probably not good news for Fox going into this advertising period. It's going to be very interesting to see if it actually sticks, if this has a sort of durable impact on their ability to generate money. If that is the case, I think that Media Matters deserves a lot of credit for holding them accountable for what they say on both the opinion and the hard news side. So we do appreciate the work that Media Matters does in this area.
Thanks so much. I mean, I don't know if you and your viewers saw this, but earlier today, Elizabeth Warren turned down the opportunity to do a town hall on Fox News because she was saying that she didn't want to direct ad dollars to what she called a hate-for-profit machine. You know, she said a Democratic town hall gives the Fox News sales team a way to tell the potential sponsors it's safe to buy ads on Fox with no risk to their brand or reputation. And it's not. And this is a point that we've been making for some time now, is there's no reason to legitimize Fox and give them cover to sell ads that will support toxic bigotry and outright propaganda throughout the whole network, which really isn't contained to Sean Hannity and Fox and Friends. Martha McCallum, who co-hosted the Bernie Sanders town hall back in April, that town hall was on April 15th. The next day, April 16th, she went on air and misrepresented his tax plan.
Yeah. Yeah, not surprising, but it is depressing. And yeah, we're going to be reading a few of Elizabeth Warren's tweets a little bit later on the show, but I appreciate you highlighting that topic. And Katie Sullivan of Media Matters for America, thank you both for the report and for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
And we're going to take a short break here. When we come back, Joe Biden on the Green New Deal, Bernie Sanders and AOC, not big fans of his plans in that area. And if we have time, we'll also be getting to Elizabeth Warren on Fox News town halls after this. Last week, we got an initial idea of what Joe Biden would do and perhaps not do when it comes to climate change. And there has been a lot of criticism of his plan from this show and from most of the environmental progressives who have been leading the charge on climate change over the last year. And so just to remind you, if you hadn't seen, according to a Reuters report, Biden is currently drafting climate change policy that, quote, will appeal to both environmentalists and the blue collar voters who elected Donald Trump. The plan will reportedly focus on initiatives such as rejoining the Paris Climate Agreement and regulations on emissions and vehicle fuel efficiency, which, look, if you just put it like that and you focus on what's there and not on what's not there, that sounds fine. It sounds like a continuation of the Obama policy. But there's a lot to not like even in that statement. First of all, there's nothing bold about it whatsoever. It is a return to most, but perhaps not even all of what we had before Donald Trump became president. And also, I would say that it philosophically is a fundamental misunderstanding of the Green New Deal and why that is the plan we need to pursue. And it's the plan that we need to pursue, not only because it is up to the task of actually dealing with the climate breakdown that we're currently facing, but also that is the plan that will appeal to blue collar voters who supported Donald Trump. Those who are focused on economic issues, issues of healthcare and all of that. That is why the Green New Deal is a comprehensive plan touching on multiple different aspects of American life and the economy. The idea that the only thing that will appeal to blue collar voters is what, slightly more regulations on methane emissions? Like slightly higher miles per gallon requirements of vehicles? First of all, if you pitch it that way, Fox News has always hated those things, and Trump supporters and supporters of Republican presidents in the past have generally been okay with going along with that. I think that the piecemeal approach has been shown to not work in appealing to conservatives, and that you need a fundamental rethinking of not only what we do in regard to climate change, but also how we communicate about the issue and the opportunities inherent in dealing with climate breakdown. That is, I think, a far better way to break through to those voters who have never considered themselves environmental progressives in the past. And so I don't like what I've heard about his plan so far, and I don't like the philosophical approach that he is going into it with. But I do want to allow him to respond a little bit. So he has said, I said that I was in this area, climate change, long before most anybody else was, and I have a record. And they basically said, talking about PolitiFact and doing a check of statements he's made about climate change, Biden's right, he's been a leader on climate change. We're going to get to how he believes that he has been a leader for a long time in the past in a second. But he says, we do need to finish this green revolution in a way that's rational. We can do it, afford it, and get it done now. And he uses the term green revolution because he wants it to sound bold, but does not want to actually sign on to the Green New Deal. So green revolution sounded great before. I like the Green New Deal, though. I think I'm going to stick with that. And what about the claims that he has been involved in the fight on climate change for a long time? He's not wrong there. So he said, I'm one of the first guys to introduce a climate change bill way back in 87. PolitiFact rated that as true. There had been debates and things like that. But that was the first bill, actually. And that's good. Look, I respect that people have been consistent for a long time. If you believe that you've been a leader on a topic, literally going back decades, I think that that is worthy of discussion. But we can also take a look at what the discussion was back then, what actually came of these debates, and whether your current plan has actually evolved along with our growing understanding of how big of a threat this actually is. If you had a bill in 1987, and we're in a far worse situation than we were in the late 80s, and you still have a late 80s mindset to actually dealing with it, I don't see that as evidence that you're the guy to lead on this issue. You seem like a guy that had some good things to say 30 or so years ago, but hasn't actually paid attention to changes in science and what we can actually do about it. So that, to me, is like 1% as valuable, saying I have this plan in the 80s, than actually putting forward a bold plan, which he now says is coming, and that we should expect it at some point. And he says that I never said that I was for a middle road, that's just how the media has pitched it. Okay, that's fine. You haven't said middle of the road, but we are going to evaluate your actual plan when we actually see it. And as of right now, we have very little. So what do people actually think about him as a leader on climate change? Well, let's turn to some of the people that I trust to be leaders on this issue, including AOC. Now, she had a big Green New Deal town hall with the Sunrise Movement just yesterday. Here is some of what she said about Biden and his approach to this issue.
I will be damned if the same politicians who refused to act then are going to try to come back today and say we need a middle of the road approach to save our lives. That is too much for me.
And I agree with her. Again, he had, like, you know what a middle of the road approach, you know when it would have worked? The late 80s. I think that it actually would have. If we had been reasonable back then and had taken climate change reasonably serious at that point, we might have been okay with carbon taxes and, you know, some subsidies and a more gradual switch over to renewable energy. That might have actually been fine at that point. But we're not at that point. The whole 12 years figure that you hear a lot coming out of the UN, which is actually, by the way, 11 years now. If that was 41 years, okay, you could have an approach like that. But it's not 41 years, it's 11. We do need more bold, quicker action, and I don't know that I actually trust him on that. Now I want to say just a little bit more about what AOC was talking about at the town hall last night. She had a great quote. She said, so often when folks, particularly conservatives on both sides of the aisle, when they say that calling for a Green New Deal is too much or too extreme or too radical, at that point someone cut in to say no middle ground. She says no middle ground is right. And she says, because I'm curious, I'm always curious when they say that, oh, it's too much. What do they actually mean by that? Is 100% clean and renewable energy too much? Is fighting for dignified jobs that pay people enough to live too much? And they don't actually say. They say that we can't afford it necessarily, relying on right-wing think tank figures of how expensive it would actually be, and say that we need something more reasonable, that we don't want to turn off conservatives. But they don't actually make the case for why conservatives, more than liberals, would be less interested in their kids living in a world where we can actually farm, where we're not dealing with massive intra and interstate conflict. All of those things. The response is always incredibly vague when the problem is incredibly specific, and I think our solution needs to be as well. Now, Bernie Sanders has also talked about this topic recently, saying the United States must lead the world with a global approach that emphasizes the Green New Deal. And when we do that, we not only address the great environmental crisis of our time, but we make millions of good paying jobs. And that is how you appeal to those Trump supporters. Not by saying, hey, wouldn't it be nice if your Accord got 2 more miles to the gallon? That is not how you actually do that. And look, in a more fundamental way, my issue with Joe Biden on this issue, it really has to do with how Joe Biden and liberals like him approach government. Now, I would say that believing in the best in people and expecting that if we band together, we can really accomplish something, that's a fine value. That is a liberal value. It's arguably a progressive value, and I do like that. Outside of government, I like it in TV shows and stuff like that. But unfortunately, I don't think that he actually knows who the Republican Party is. So in New Hampshire, he predicted that once President Trump is out of office recently, he said Republicans will have an epiphany and work with Democrats towards consensus. No, they will not. They won't have an epiphany, and they certainly won't work with Democrats. They will become the resistance at that point. And this, by the way, is not a prediction. This is not just me looking forward and assuming that that will be the case. That is what they were for an 8-year period that few people in American politics should understand better than Joe Biden, because Joe Biden was the vice president when Republicans refused to work with Obama on literally anything. That was not after an epiphany after Trump. That was before Trump was actually an issue. That's what the Republican Party was. And they have only become more extreme and more entrenched in the radical positions than they were back when they weren't working with you on anything. Why would you believe that suddenly the need to appeal to a more extreme Trump base would make them, what, more bipartisan? I don't believe that. And I just fundamentally don't trust that Joe Biden has actually learned nearly enough over the past 30 years. Let me bring this up. Jess Bidgood of the Boston Globe said, in Nashua, Joe Biden again defended the 1994 crime bill, second day in a row, saying this idea that the crime bill generated mass incarceration, it did not generate mass incarceration. And he gives some other reasons that he thinks other things were to blame for that. I guess that's an argument that he can have, but it certainly is out of step with not just progressive thought in the Democratic Party, but the mainstream of the Democratic Party. He has not learned some of the easiest to learn lessons from the 80s and 90s. And for an issue that has moved so fast since that time, I don't know that he can be trusted. Now, unfortunately, we don't have more time to get into that. We are going to be moving on. We're going to take a break. We come back. Trump's tax plan, how bad was it? How big was it for business? We'll get into that after this. Trump tax plan was in many ways a Republican dream come true, something that they had been working on in the years since the last time they were able to do a massive tax cut for the wealthy and corporations. But how did we actually get there? And those massive numbers that we've talked about of money being moved around in one direction or the other, how did it actually come to be? Well, joining us now to break down that process is Alan Holmes, senior business reporter at the Center for Public Integrity. Alan, welcome to the Damage Report.
Nice to be here. Thank you.
Glad to have you here. And I know that you did a 6-month investigation of the process that led to those Trump tax cuts. What are some of the standout things that you were able to discover in your research?
Well, the number one thing is that this was pure and simple a corporate tax cut bill. That's what they wanted. They wanted to redo, get the rate down. Even Obama administration wanted to do that, but they came much, much lower than Obama had agreed to, about a 28% rate from a 35% rate. But what really stood out on this is that then after that, everything just flowed through on that. You know, small business wanted tax cuts and individual tax cuts, and then they had to find revenue here and there, which then really was targeted at blue states. But really what they really wanted to do is get corporations a major tax cut. And the argument was that this would then flow down to the middle class, but it was done very, very quickly, done basically in 51 days. And there's a lot of problems that are going to have to be fixed. Democrats aren't going to really be willing to want to go in on helping them fix this, especially with them controlling the House. And they're going to try to extract a lot of concessions that they want to do, such as, let's say, increasing the earned income tax credit, which would help low-income and middle-income folks.
So let's talk a little bit about the money coming in and going out. So you had Trump initially wanted an even larger tax cut for corporations, right? His was at something like 15%, I think?
Yep. That's what he campaigned on. And there was just absolutely no way they were going to be able to pay for that. The reason Obama had agreed to 28% corporate tax, you can fiddle around with the tax code and get to a point where you can pay for that. But once you start going below 28%, it starts getting very, very difficult. The rule of thumb is that for every 1% that you drop corporate income tax rate, you're going to create about $100 billion deficit over 10 years. So it you can imagine if you go down to 15%, people, even some conservative Republicans were thinking, wow, that's really deep. That's going to create some huge, huge debt, such as somewhere in the neighborhood of $3 to $7 trillion over 10 years.
Yeah, so we're talking about absolutely massive numbers. And what strikes me is that even before this gigantic, like as you're saying, larger than they had wanted tax cut for businesses, the overall share of the tax burden in the country that was being paid by corporations had been trending down, I believe, for decades at that point. That has had some gasoline thrown on it thanks to this bill. But in your report, you also talk about there had been some proposals, I think from Paul Ryan and perhaps others, that could have made this more, at least hypothetically, revenue neutral. And those options were not actually pursued.
That's right. In June, right before the presidential election in 2016, so June 2016, Brady and Ryan unveiled what's called a Better Way. And it's basically an agenda for the coming Congress to consider. And they, at that time, you remember, they thought that Hillary Clinton was going to be elected. So it was written up as a way of compromising with the Democrats. And in that was something called the border adjustment tax, where you would tax imports coming in. That was going to raise about $1 trillion over 10 years. That's a lot of money to pay for tax cuts in other places. But come November, Trump wins. And as one lobbyist said, it was basically, okay, how low can we go with the corporate tax rate? All bets were off. The Republicans were in control. And that just changed the dynamics totally about what was going to be tax reform. And tax reform is basically trying to make the tax law and tax code fairer for everybody, to basically tax cuts and creating huge deficits.
And so you have a bill that was largely drafted in secret, and the actual process was incredibly quick in comparison to something like the ACA that was this, you know, interminable process over months and months. And then to get it passed, in your report you talk about what was done to, while they were counting votes, what they were doing to appeal to individual senators. Do you have any examples of some of the changes that were made to the bill to ensure that they would get certain votes?
Well, the number one thing that was done, and this is what made the whole tax cut bill possible, was that you had to have come up with something called budget reconciliation. And the reason they did that is that you only needed 51 votes to get through the Senate rather than 60. On the budget committee, the Senate budget committee then sets that number. And they only had 11 Republicans to 10 Democrats. You lose one Republican and you lose budget reconciliation and tax cut bill is dead. The person they were worried about was Senator Corker out of Tennessee. He's a known deficit hawk. He called the deficit a bigger threat than the threat from North Korea at one point. And so to appease him, they had to come up with a pretty complicated, and I don't know if I have time to go into it, but a pretty complicated accounting method to show that this was going to not create huge deficits. But they're basically, people call these a lot of these gimmicks smoke and mirrors. But they convinced him that they could get to what close to deficit neutral, meaning that, you know, increase in economic activity would create more tax revenue. They had something called current policy baseline, which I won't even begin to try to explain to you, but that was going to raise another $500 billion. And they convinced him that this would be the case. And so it voted out of the budget committee at 11 to 10. And that's what set the course for the tax bill to go through. They convinced him.
And we know that a lot of those sort of economic tricks that they would employ, or that the right wing think tanks that were generating these like fanciful ideas of how much economic output would be spurred by this, inevitably those numbers always get revised. I mean, even the overall cost of this tax bill, it seems like every couple of months it's being revised upward, which is depressing in its own way. I am curious, in your research, there had been talk before the midterm elections, Donald Trump saying that they were readying to do some sort of second round of tax cuts. Is that still a thing that's being debated? Maybe the switch over in the House might have changed that calculus. Did you see anything in that area?
No, I don't think you're going to see that coming up. Trump sold this as a cut to the middle class. Yes, some of the individual rates were cut, but by far goes to the wealthy and the top 1%. They wanted to try to get something through this year. They also tried to do something near the end of the year of the last Congress. But Democrats just aren't ready to play ball. If you recall back in the ACA, that was passed totally by a party line vote for the Democrats, and the Republicans never even wanted to consider trying to improve on some of the problems that they were having, that, you know, that any bill needs to be, or any law needs to be tweaked afterwards. Mm-hmm. This one's quite an exception, though. The Tax Cuts and Jobs Act is quite an exception. But you're not going to see any tax cuts coming up soon. It's in the tax law right now, they're due to expire in 2025. For individual cuts, not corporate. So everybody's taxes will probably go back up then, unless they extend them.
Exactly. Yeah, it's funny how that works out. Alan Holmes, thank you so much for joining us. We really appreciate your reporting. And if anybody watching wants more detail, they can go over to the website for the Center for Public Integrity and see an amazing write-up about your research.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you. We're going to take one last break. When we come back, Elizabeth Warren calling for candidates not to appear in town halls on Fox News. We're going to lay out her argument after this. Should Democrats do town halls on Fox News? That is a debate that has been going on for a couple of months now. And not too long ago, actually, Bernie Sanders, a politician that I tolerate at times, he laid out the case for why he feels that he should do that. Now, he said at the time that I've done town halls with Fox News before. I know who they are, but I also know my ability to communicate with the voters in a town hall-like environment. I have access to different sorts of voters if I go on Fox News. And in the past, I have been successful in breaking through. And at the time, he talked about some of the lines that he had given in his past town hall that worked very well and might have been successful in drawing some of those conservative voters over to the Democratic side. And then he did his town hall. And if you recall, there were those moments where the host tried to get him on Medicare for All, and it turned out that they were in a room full of people who were very much interested in Medicare for All. And so he certainly looked like he had made a good move there. Now Elizabeth Warren is making the case that Democrats, in fact, should not appear on the town hall. And I want to read some of the tweets that she put out laying out this case. Now understand, this comes after she was asked by Fox News to do a town hall. And here is what she said. After saying, by the way, I love town halls. I've done tons of town halls. I'm just not doing it with you. She says, Fox News is a hate-for-profit racket that gives a megaphone to racists and conspiracists. It's designed to turn us against each other, risking life and death consequences to provide cover for the corruption that's rotting our government and hollowing out our middle class. That is a tweet right there. And I don't think anything there is inaccurate, but we're gonna go on. Hate for profit works only if there's profit. So Fox News balances a mix of bigotry, racism, and outright lies with enough legit journalism to make the claim to advertisers that it's a reputable news outlet. It's all about dragging in ad money, big ad money. But Fox News is struggling as more and more advertisers pull out of their hate-filled space. A Democratic town hall gives the Fox News sales team a way to tell potential sponsors it's safe to buy ads on Fox. No harm to their brand or reputation. Spoiler, it's not. And then she concludes, here's one place we can fight back. I won't ask millions of Democratic primary voters to tune into an outlet that profits from racism and hate in order to see our candidates. Especially when Fox will make even more money adding our valuable audience to their ratings numbers. And that is a pretty convincing argument that she spins there. Now, for a bit of context, on today's episode of the Damage Report, we had a representative of Media Matters on to talk about their analysis of the news side of Fox News and how often they lie uniformly in a direction that misinforms the voters and leads them to be more supportive of Republican causes and politicians on some of the most important issues that are being talked about today, including climate change and immigration, the tax bill, the Mueller report, and all of that. They just coincidentally always lie in a direction that seems to benefit conservatives. And that is their objective journalism side, let alone obviously we talk quite often about Sean Hannity and Tucker Carlson and how often they are lying in a particularly insidious and often racist way. As one example, I didn't get a chance to talk about on the show, but I wanted to. Understand, Fox News is currently trying to appeal to advertisers to get advertising dollars for the next year. And so this week, Tucker Carlson, they're doing big advertisement for his week on homelessness. Doesn't that sound wholesome? Doesn't that sound like good old-fashioned journalism, shedding light on the issue of homelessness, especially amongst the veteran population, which is a gigantic problem? Oh, but then you tune in and it's an heir, a millionaire heir on cable news complaining about how he has to see homeless people. And he only talks about homelessness in blue states as if it's not a problem in states with Republican governors. It's a disgusting way to vilify people who literally don't even have homes and TVs to see them being vilified in. And that's who they are. That is who Fox News is. And we know that they spread conspiracy theories about the caravans and all of that. They're driving religious and racial hatred towards any number of different groups. Elizabeth Warren is not wrong there. And so I'm honestly torn at this point. I get the Bernie Sanders sort of argument that if you go to this place, that is the best way to meet these people and to have them be exposed to your argument. That is true, but at what cost? Like, it might benefit the politician, it might benefit the party, it might have an effect on the election, but it is helping to prop up an organization that is on very shaky ground right now with advertisers, and very justifiably so, because they have been pushing homophobia, lies about any number of different issues, and misogyny and racism and all of that. Elizabeth Warren is 100% right about that. And so while at the end of the day, it's obviously going to be up to each individual candidate to decide how they use their time and who they want to focus their message on. And while obviously I'm going to be generally supportive of Bernie Sanders, at this point, I find Elizabeth Warren's argument pretty compelling, and I would probably advise that if you're going to appear on Fox News, you should have a damn good reason for it in the future. Now with that, we unfortunately didn't have time to get to Meanwhile In, but tomorrow it's going to be J.R. Jackson, Brooke is gonna be back in. They'll talk about that and a number of other issues. I'm actually out for the rest of the week. So you've got 3 days of Brooke and JR. Brett is gonna be leading with Francesca, and Anna Kasparian is going to be hosting an episode of The Damage Report to close out the week. Should be a lot of fun. I'll be back after a trip to the East Coast next Monday with much more for you. See you then.
Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.